This is Medieval Death Trip for Saturday, May 3rd, 2025, Episode 114, The Voyage of the Ikora, Part 1. Hello and welcome to Medieval Death Trip, the show where we explore the wit and weirdness of medieval texts. I'm your host, Patrick Lane. Today, we're continuing from our check-in with St. Patrick last episode into more Irish literature. This time not a Latin text by a Romano-British expat living in Ireland, but an Irish language text by, presumably, an Irish writer. Our author for today is anonymous, but it would be rather rare for someone who wasn't Irish to be writing in the Irish language in this period. Our story is the Imram Curach Í Cora, which means the Voyage of the Curach of the Grandchildren of Cora, more commonly referred to in English as the Voyage of the Í Cora. It's one of the many tales of sea voyages to wondrous places in Irish literature and folklore, the Voyage of St. Brendan being perhaps the most well-known. Now, despite being titled The Voyage of the Í Cora, the first third or so of the story takes place on land, all prelude to the voyage itself. And because this is a moderately lengthy text, we're going to be breaking it up into two parts. So we'll do the landlocked part one this episode, and set sail in part two. Next time, we'll talk more about the form and genre of this narrative, the Imram, but for our introduction to it, let's learn a little bit about the textual history of this story. Our earliest surviving version of the story is preserved in the Book of Fermoy and was copied out in the 1400s. However, the story is referenced by title in a list of tales in the Book of Leinster, which was made around 1160, so some version was circulating at least that far back. And there is a reference to the three main characters, the Í Cora, in a text from around the year 900, so the storyline might be as old as that, if not older. That said, the reference is just names, and there's no way of knowing if they were connected to the narrative as we have it now, or if later storytellers pulled those names out of the tradition and attached them to this story, a bit like some of the theories about how Kenelm got attached to the princely martyrdom we talked about a couple of episodes ago. Additionally, and we'll talk about this more next episode when we discuss genre, we don't really know to what degree this story was rooted in an ancient oral tradition, or how much of it might have been freshly composed by a monkish author in the later Middle Ages. It certainly feels like an old mythical tale, but compositionally it has a number of later medieval trappings. So we're once again dipping into the grand tradition of medieval texts like Beowulf or many of the Norse sagas, where there are deep debates over how much older the stories are than the time of their being written, and if they're actually good evidence for the content of ancient mythological traditions, or if they're just later authors' inventions. The translation we'll be hearing comes from an edition made by Whitley Stokes in 1893, based on the Book of Fermoy text, filled in with some readings from a later manuscript where the Fermoy text was damaged. And when I say later manuscript, the text being used was copied out in 1744, so very post-medieval. We also have an important variant of the narrative that includes sections written in verse, which we first find incompletely preserved in another manuscript from the 1700s, and then the remaining copies of it are all handwritten manuscripts from the 1800s. Not quite the medieval manuscripts we usually picture. But through the 18th and 19th centuries, a scribal culture persisted in Ireland, especially in the west of Ireland, carried out not so much by monks, but by people of a literary persuasion, poets and storytellers, schoolmasters and local historians, who preserved Irish language materials, including copying from medieval manuscripts, or copies of copies from medieval manuscripts, that haven't survived into our day. Often this scribal habit ran in families, and particular households became repositories of knowledge. In fact, five copies of the mixed prose and poetic versions of the Voyage of the Í Cora were all made by members of the O'Longan family. So, we can credit early medieval Irish scribes with a great deal of the preservation of classical texts, and industrial-era Irish scribes with the preservation of much medieval Irish literature and history in a period when the Irish language was facing a significant decline as the use of English rose in the country. And when I say English use rose, that's glossing over a deliberate effort by the ruling British authorities to marginalize Irish and put English at the center of education and public life. This is embodied in our translator, Whitley Stokes, a Dublin-born lawyer who spent the 1860s and 70s practicing law in India, where he was also actively publishing scholarly work on Celtic studies. But despite being a prolific and celebrated translator of Old Irish and Middle Irish texts, he allegedly never became a fluent speaker of modern Irish, not having learned and practiced it growing up. I don't know how exactly Stokes got his hands on many of his materials while he was in India, but he drew on many of these later manuscript copies. The preservation work of the modern era Irish scribes is hugely important, but they do introduce some complications for scholars today. Like many other 18th and 19th century folklorists and antiquarians, these scribes were often more interested in preserving the stories rather than the text per se. For example, the mixed prose and poetic version of the story very likely is the product of an 18th century scribe taking two fragmentary versions of the story, one in prose and one in verse, and fusing them together to make a hybrid whole and then passing that version down through members of the O'Longan family. So while that's great for folkloric preservation, it certainly makes it difficult to get closer to the specifics of what the medieval form of the tale was. The copy preserved in the Book of Fermoy certainly is medieval, late medieval, but even its provenance is rather unclear. The Book of Fermoy itself, Royal Irish Academy Manuscript 23E29, is a real jumble. It's a classic scrapbook-style codex, or composite codex, to use the proper terminology, assembled from different items copied out at different times. And unlike many of the manuscripts we meet in this show, this one was not the product of a monastery, but was the property of an aristocratic family, the Roaches of Castletown Roach in County Cork. The Roaches appear to have acquired some texts and then commissioned scribes to copy others, primarily historical and legendary material in Irish, some prose, some poetic. Quite a few leaves of the manuscript have significant damage and staining on them, rendering the text illegible. This is very suggestive of the text spending some time separate and unbound, since it is most commonly the front and back pages of smaller packets or quires of leaves that get that kind of damage from being left out on tables or open shelves and exposed to sunlight and spills and general wear and tear. At some point in the 17th or 18th centuries, the book came into the possession of a family of hereditary physicians, the O'Hickeys, who appear to have added a series of medical texts to the end of the collection, just making the whole thing even more eclectic. Much of the physical evidence we would normally use to figure out how it was all originally bound together has been lost. When the Book of Fermoy was cataloged in 1858, it was described as no longer having a proper binding, just being tacked together with a vellum wrapper. In fact, there's some thought that those medical texts may not exactly have been added to the manuscript by the O'Hickeys, but rather may have been accidentally gathered up with the other leaves of the manuscript whenever it got passed on to its next owner, who then treated this as all one book. This rather ragged assembly was rebound in the late 1800s, which resulted in the further destruction of what little remained of the original binding marks that had been there along the crumbling edges of the leaves. Scholars have also identified leaves that must have come from the Book of Fermoy bound into other manuscripts, so there clearly was some scattering of its parts before that Victorian rebinding. And then, even the 19th century binding was replaced in the 1970s with an eye towards better conservation of the vellum, so the object we have today is far from whatever was being handled by the Roaches 600 years ago. But let's hear what the Roaches might have heard, at least, recited around a dinner table, or perhaps read quietly to themselves. More or less. As I mentioned, the first leaf of this text is one of the ones that's been damaged, and Stokes has filled in the gaps with bits of a version preserved much later. The translation has been made from Irish prose, but you'll probably notice quite a bit of poetic diction shining through, which may also hint at a bardic tradition adapted into prose by our 15th century scribe. For example, listen for the sets of rhetorical triplets in the opening description. Also, a bit of cultural vocab, we're going to encounter the word Erenach, which is an Irish ecclesiastical officer who typically wasn't ordained but served as an administrator for church properties. The modern name McInerney comes from Mac Erenach, son of the Erenach, which could easily become a family name because, as a layperson, the Erenach could marry, and the office was often passed down from father to son as a kind of family possession. So, let's hear the first not quite half of the Imram Curac Ikora, the Voyage of the Boat of the Ikora, as recorded in the Book of Fermoy and translated by Whitley Stokes. Here is the voyage of the Ikora's boat. A princely landholder, hundreded, combative, was born once upon a time in the dear and beautiful province of Connaught, to wit, Conall the Red, descendant of Cora the Fair. Thus was that landholder, a man happy, wealthy, exceeding prosperous, and never had his house been found without three cries therein, to wit, the cry of the strainers a-straining ale, the cry of the vassals over the cauldrons a-forking out joints to the hosts, and the cry of the warriors at the chessboards a-winning games from each other. Never, too, was his house found without the three sacks, to wit, a sack of malt for preparing yeast, a sack of wheat for preparing the refection of the guests, and a sack of salt to make every food taste well. This was his wife, Caer Derg, daughter of the Erenach. No want, in sooth, had they, save that they had no fitting children. And not altogether childless were they, but their children would not stay with them, and died immediately after their birth. So, one night, in his bed, the landholder said to his wife, "It is sad for us," says he, "not to have a son to be a fitting successor in our place after us." "What wouldst thou fain do, therefore?" says the wife. "This is what I would fain do," says the landholder. "Make communion with the devil, if perchance he would give us a son or daughter as successor, who would take our place after us." "So let it be done," says the wife. Then they fasted against the devil, and the lady forthwith became with child, and she was nurturing her pregnancy till the end of her 9 months. Thereafter came unto the lady great efforts and mighty birth pangs, and she bore three sons in that great bringing forth, to wit, a son at the beginning of the night, a son at midnight, and a son at the end of the night. And they were baptized according to the heathen baptism, and these were their names, even Lochan, Aenna, and Sylvester. Thereafter they were nourished and carefully tended until they were swift and strong on sea and on land, so that they outwent their coevals in every play and in every fair discipline, and full lips and constant tongue had everyone who used to hear them or see them at that time. One day, when they were leaning on the side rail of the bed in their father and mother's house, wearied with charging and hurling, the people of the house said that they had found neither fault nor blemish on those smooth, delightful, greatly famous sons, save only their baptism into the devil's possession. "If," say the sons, "it is the devil who is our king or lord, it is hard for us not to rob and plunder and persecute his enemies, that is, to kill clerics and to burn and wreck churches." Then those sons arose, and they took their weapons, and went to Tuam, and they wrecked and burnt the place, and committed robbery and outrageous brigandage throughout the province of Connacht upon churches and clerics, so that the evil and horror of their robbery was heard of throughout the four quarters of Ireland altogether. Till the end of a year they dealt in that wise, so that during that time they destroyed one more than half of the churches of Connacht. At the end of a year, Lochan said to his brothers, "We have been very forgetful," says he, "and our lord the devil will not be thankful to us concerning it." "What is this?" says the other sons. "Our grandfather," says he, "even our mother's father. We have not killed him and burnt his church upon him." They go to his country on the spot, without truce, without sparing. The Erenach was there before them on the green of the church, with a great assembly of his community around him, to serve them and attend them with the choice of every food and the flower of every liquor. And the secret intention of the cleric towards them was not that which they had towards him, but to kill him and to burn and wreck his church. Then came the Ikora to the place wherein the cleric dwelt, and they determined not to kill the cleric, nor to burn the stead, until the night should come, and the kine and cattle of the stead should come to their byres and their proper places. The cleric comes with them to the stead, and he perceived that they had this secret intention, and he put them into the fair-sided, shining solar, and food and ale were taken to them, so that they became exhilarated and mirthful. Afterwards, couches and lofty beds were spread for them. Then a deep slumber and sleep fell upon Lokan, and a marvelous vision was shown to him, to wit, he was taken to see heaven and hell. And then he awoke. The other two also awoke and said, "Let us go," say they, "to wreck and destroy the stead." "Meseems," says Lokan, "that is not what is meetest for us to do. For evil is the Lord whom we have served, and good is the Lord on whom we have hitherto wrought robbery and brigandage. And I beheld a vision hideous and awful, to wit, that I was borne away to see heaven and also hell, a place wherein were abundance of punishments on the throngs of human souls and on devils. So I saw the four rivers of hell, even a river of toads and a river of serpents, a river of fire and a river of snow. I beheld the monster of hell with abundance of heads and feet upon it, and all the men of the world would die of seeing it. Thereafter, I perceived that I was borne away to gaze at heaven, and I beheld the Lord himself on his throne, and a bird flock of angels making music to him. Then I saw a bright bird, and sweeter was his singing than every melody. Now, this was Michael in the form of a bird in the presence of the Creator. This is my counsel to you, says Lokan, to quit your weapons and in future to follow God. What is that? Says Aenna. Will the Lord accept from us repentance for the great evils we have wrought? They go to their mother's father and ask that question of him. God would accept it without doubt, quoth he. If so, saith Lokan, let mass be said to us outside in this stead, and let us make staves of our spear shafts, and let us go to Findon, the foster father of Ireland. Thus was it done by them. They fare forward on the morrow to Clonard, to the place where Findon was biding. There he was then, on the green of the stead. Whom have we here? Say the clerics who were along with the saint. These are the Ikora, the marauders, says one of them. All who were along with Findon fled and left him alone. It seemed to them that the Ikora had come to kill them. The clerics are fleeing before us, saith Lokan. That is so, surely, say his brothers. Let us cast from us our staves, the remains that we have of our weapons, and let us make genuflection to the cleric. Thus they did. What is your desire? Says the elder. We are fain, say they, to believe and be pious and to serve God, and to quit the Lord with whom we have been hitherto, even the devil. Good is that counsel, says the cleric. Come over with me, says he, into the stead, to the place where stands the assembly. They go with him into the stead. Then the assembly made a resolve, to wit, that a son of the church should be instructing them, that they should speak to none save their tutor, and that their instruction should continue till the end of a year. A year were they on that wise, so that they read the canonical scriptures. When they finished that, the assembly was thankful for their piety and their good manners. At the end of a year, they came to Findon and prostrated themselves before him and said, "It is time to pass judgment upon us for the great evils we have wrought." "What is that?" says Findon. "Is it not enough for you to be in this assembly even as ye are?" "It is not enough," say they. "What are the greatest evils ye have wrought?" says the cleric. "We have burnt one more than half of the churches of Connacht, and neither bishop nor priest got abatement of quarter at our hands." "Ye will not succeed," says Findon, "in putting souls into the men ye have murdered. But there is one thing ye could do, to wit, building houses in the place of the churches ye have burnt, and restoring everything else ye have destroyed in those churches. And I," says he, "will put the vigor and strength of 100 into each man of you, and I will banish from you weariness of feet and hands and small of back, and I will give you growth and profit which will never fail." Well then, they went forward thence to Tuam, and began to work and slave there until they completed the renewal and restoration of everything which they had destroyed in the place. By the end of the year, they had been at every church throughout Connacht, restoring everything which they had previously destroyed, and then they came to have speech with Findon. "Have ye finished?" asked Findon, "restoring every church which ye destroyed?" "We have finished," say they, "save only one stead, even Kinvara." "Sad in sooth," says Findon, "that is the first stead which ye ought to restore, to wit, the stead of that holy Aranach, old Common of Kinvara. And now, depart and restore that stead well, and every judgment which that holy old nun shall pass upon you, execute it patiently." Thereafter, they go to Kinvara and restored everything that they had destroyed therein. One day, when they came forth over the edge of the haven, they were contemplating the sun as he went past them westwards, and they marveled much concerning his course. "And in what direction goes the sun," say they, "when he goes under the sea? And what more wondrous thing," say they, "that the sea without ice, and ice on every other water?" That is the resolve they formed, to bring to them a certain wight who was a friend of theirs and who was in that country, and to get him to build for them a three-skinned boat. The boat was built so that it was ready, strong, and staunch. This is the price which the wright asked for building it, that he himself should be allowed to go with them in the boat. Now, when it was time for them to embark, they beheld a troop passing them, and this was the troop, a party of jesters. The jesters saw the boat being launched on the sea. "Who are the people launching this boat on the sea?" say they. Said the buffoon of the party, "I recognize them," quoth he, "three sons of Conall the Red, descendant of Corra the Fair of Connacht, the robbers and brigands, going on their pilgrimage to seek the Lord on the sea and on the mighty main. Howbeit," quoth he, "by my word, they do not need more than I to go and seek for heaven." "By my word," quoth the leader of the party, "it is long till thou shalt go on thy pilgrimage." "Say not so, it shall be done," quoth the buffoon, "but I will go with them here on my pilgrimage now without delay." "We have thy word," say the jesters, "that thou wouldst not take our dresses with thee, for naught of the raiment upon thee is thine own." "It is not that which will keep me with you," quoth he. So everything was stripped off him, and they let him go from them to the boat, fierce, stark naked. "What thing art thou, O man?" say the crew. "A wretched man going with you on this pilgrimage," says he. "Thou shalt not come," say they, "and thou fierce, stark naked." "Say not that, O warriors," quoth he. "For God's sake, refuse me not, and I will make you merriment of mind and nature, and your act of devotion will not be the less." They agreed to let him go with them for God's sake. Thus were they then, after building a church and an altar to the Lord on their own heritage. "Let us go now on board our boat," says Lochan, "since we have finished restoring the churches we destroyed, and since we have built a church to the Lord on our own heritage." 9 now was their number, and among them was a bishop, a priest, and a deacon. One Gilly they had, he was the 9th man. Then they made fervent prayer to God in order that they might find fair weather, and that the Lord would restrain the storm of the waves and the roaring of the sea and the many awful monsters. Then when they went on board their boat and began to row, they were thinking whither they should go. "Whithersoever the wind shall take us," says the bishop. Thereafter they shipped their oars and offered themselves to God. So, thus begins the voyage of the Ikora. We'll follow them out to sea next episode. But this transition point in the story is where some of the questions about the origins of this text pop into focus. Namely, why do the brothers go on their sea voyage? Is it part of this penance they're performing for all the devilish deeds of their youth? Only partly? It seems more to be the result of a newfound curiosity about the world. Where does the sun go when it sets in the west? Why, in midwinter, when the lakes are frozen, is the sea still liquid? They ask these questions and then commission a boat to go exploring in. Now, you could argue that this curiosity is a product of the more meditative mindset they've acquired in their ascetic conversion. It does fit as the next step on their spiritual evolution, but I'm not sure I'd call it a natural next step. So, right here, we're looking at one of the first major signs that we might be dealing with a bit of a mashup narrative, that two separate stories have been merged together. The first would be a fairly simple conversion narrative of heathen marauders who repent their crimes and become, essentially, monks. There are quite a few stories like that. The story of St. Macald of Manx fits this pattern, as we heard in episode 75, concerning more challenges to the throne of man. And the second story would be a tour of wondrous islands at the edges of the world by a boat of pilgrims led by a saintly figure, which is where we're headed next episode. And one other little sign to note, who is it who asserts, "We will go wherever the wind takes us"? Is it one of the Ikora? No, it's this unnamed bishop who steps up. And so when we get to part two, pay attention to who seems to be in charge and whose story this seems to have become. But speaking of the other crew members, the character Stokes calls the buffoon is identified in the Irish text as a croson, which more specifically means a satiric poet or mimic, a comic performer who pokes fun at others or composes sharp-tongued or obscene verse. There's also some hint in later accounts that they had a reputation as ruffians and troublemakers who very much bit the hands that fed them. So that may underlie this croson's urge for repentance. All that is to say, buffoon doesn't quite conjure an accurate image of this character. We also have introduced here, without preface, a gilly. You might recognize this term from a modern Scottish context, where a gilly is the person you hire to lead you on a hunting or fishing trip. In this story, we're back to an older sense of the word, which was just servant or attendant in general, often a young boy. So the gilly here is kind of the cabin boy, except this boat has no cabins. We'll see more of these crew members in the second part of the story. Before we wrap up, I also want to call out the list of the three cries in a good home, or the trí goidhre. And that word, goidhre, can mean a shout, like a hunting or battle cry, but is also used for laughter. And I like that semantic blending in this environment of a leading landholder's hall. I also like that among the three cries, one is of the warriors playing chess. The word translated as warriors here is the same one used to describe both the abbot and the Erenach in the story featured in the appendix for this episode, available to all our Patreon supporters. And that word can also signify just a man in the prime of life, which in this farmstead context does mean men who would likely occasionally go off on raids and defend against raids, and thus are warriors as part of their overall responsibilities. But the word also just kind of means the dudes of the house, right? But I find the next word more interesting. The word used in the manuscript for the game they are playing is a form of fickle. In modern Irish and in the 1400s, when the Book of Fermoy text was being written down, this word means chess. But it originates as the name for a different, much older board game played by Celtic peoples before the medieval fad of chess came through and swept all those older games aside. Here, we can assume that our scribe, at least, was most likely picturing chess when writing out this description, but if there is preservation of an older bardic text here, it's possible that the original reference was to that ancient game, which carried its own mythological connotations. You can hear more about the medieval history of chess and some of the games it supplanted in our chess miniseries in episode 61 to 65. One last little detail I appreciate here in my time of life is the triad of body parts that Findon blesses not to experience weariness while the brothers rebuild the churches: feet, hands, and small of back. The Irish word there for small of back is midback, which, as near as I can tell, is unrelated to English and Germanic back. The mid is recognizable, meaning middle or center, but back, B-A-C, means a bend or angle in Irish. So your mid-back is your middle bending point. Anyway, I know language is full of idioms relating to back pain and manual labor. You have back-breaking labor, you have being bent under burdens, etc., etc. But despite all that, my own subjective take is that the quotidian reality of lumbar pain is not that commonly represented in medieval art. So this little shout-out to it here feels especially naturalistic and human in a text whose characters are, for the most part, cartoons. Before we go, I also want to acknowledge one of my sources for this two-parter, which is an episode of the Story Archaeology podcast, hosted by Chris Thompson and Isolde Carmody. They discussed the voyage of the Ikora in an episode from July of 2014 as part of a series looking at the surviving Imrama. They dig into a lot of points in the narrative that I also wanted to talk about, but would feel like I was plagiarizing after the fact now, so I'll direct you to their episode for further analysis of the tale by people who have a much deeper grounding in Irish mythology and Irish traditions than I do. A link to their episode can be found in the episode description in your podcast app, and in the episode post on our website, medievaldeathtrip.com. Now, to our riddle. In the spirit of the croissant, here's a non-medieval riddle in verse by one of the great Irish satirists, Jonathan Swift. So, more accurately, an Anglo-Irish satirist, a distinction I know that matters a great deal to some. Actually, there's a small chance this riddle wasn't written by Swift. In the volume in which it was published, there is this note, quote, "About 9 or 10 years ago, i.e. about 1724, some ingenious gentlemen, friends to the author, used to entertain themselves with writing riddles and send them to him and their other acquaintances, copies of which ran about, and some of them were printed, both here and in England. The author, at his leisure hours, fell into the same amusement, although it be said that he thought them of no great merit, entertainment, or use. However, by the advice of some persons for whom the author hath a great esteem, and who were pleased to send us the copies, we have ventured to print the few following, as we have done 2 or 3 before, and which are allowed to be genuine, because we are informed that several good judges have a taste for such kind of compositions." End quote. The "allowed to be genuine" qualifier in there certainly seems to me to mean that these are riddles he's claiming authorship of, but some editors label these as riddles by Swift and friends. That certainly fits with 18th century literary culture, with all of its little pen pal groups and pen names and pseudonyms and the dawn of the literary periodical, where you do have people engaged in what they see as a kind of collective art production. So it's by no means out of bounds that Swift might present a collection of the group's riddles in his own volume. But without further ado, here is one of those riddles. It is a bit long, so I won't read it through twice, which means you'll just really have to pay attention to work out your answer, or, you know, you can rewind. So here it is, one of the riddles attributed to Jonathan Swift, title to be revealed later, since the title states the answer. "Because I am by nature blind, I wisely choose to walk behind. However, to avoid disgrace, I let no creature see my face. My words are few, but spoke with sense, and yet my speaking gives offense. Or if to whisper I presume, the company will fly the room. By all the world I am oppressed, and my oppression gives them rest. Through me, though sore against my will, instructors every art instill. By thousands I am sold and bought, who neither get nor lose a groat. For none, alas, by me can gain, but those who give me greatest pain. Shall man presume to be my master, who's but my caterer and taster? Yet, though I always have my will, I'm but a mere depender still, a humble hanger-on at best, of whom all people make a jest. In me detractors seek to find two vices of a different kind. I'm too profuse, some censurers say, and all I get, I let it fly, while others give me many a curse, because too close I hold my purse. But this I know, in either case, they dare not charge me to my face. 'Tis true, indeed, sometimes I save, sometimes run out of all I have. But when the year is at an end, computing what I get and spend, my goings out and comings in, I cannot find I lose or win. And therefore, all that know me say, I justly keep the middle way. I'm always by my betters led, I last get up and first a bed. Though, if I rise before my time, the learned in sciences sublime consult the stars and thence foretell good luck to those with whom I dwell." So, the title of this riddle, which will give you the answer, is "On the Posteriors." Now, knowing the answer, that the speaker is a butt, assuming you didn't work it out during the riddle, I strongly encourage you to go back and listen to it again. What on first read is cryptic becomes pretty funny, depending on your tolerance for fart and poo jokes. And that brings us to the end of this episode. You can find the references for this episode in the show notes posted on our website, medievaldeathtrip.com. You can also reach me by email there at patrick@medievaldeathtrip.com, and there are also links to our several social media accounts there, such as Instagram, Blue Sky, and Mastodon. You can support the show through Patreon for as little as $1 a month. Our Patreon supporters get access to bonus audio content, including appendix episodes, like the one for this episode, as well as several others, and a whole audiobook of Jordanus's Wonders of the East, which I think makes for a nice bit of summer reading, or listening, as the case may be. I'd like to thank some of our new and returning Patreon patrons. So thank you so much, Laura and Sangeetha. Your support really does make it possible for this show to keep going, especially in a period of rising prices and stagnant wages. And so, we will follow where the winds blow the little Kurok of the Ikora next episode in part 2. Until then, remember, if you're going to go sailing stark naked, at least be fierce. And thanks for listening.